obviously the direct effect of warfare in terms of the deaths of hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians who were innocent in this, of what whatever brutality or whatever problems of the Saddam Hussein regime might represent, and as well the deaths of soldiers that would be sent to carry out the war.
You need to reconcile anything. Notice you said that they're holding me up. I'm not presenting myself as anything more than what I am, an American citizen who's very concerned about the situation in Iraq.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Friday, November 15th. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The chief UN weapons inspector on the eve of his departure to Baghdad said today that inspections will likely resume November 27th, and he urged President Saddam Hussein to declare all his nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons programs. If Iraq maintains as it did in its letter accepting the return of inspectors, it has no weapons of mass destruction, Hans Blix said at the United States, that the United States or any country with evidence of secret Iraqi programs must produce it for the inspectors. It will be the moment for those who claim they have evidence to put it on the table, Blix said at a news conference. Security Council Resolution 1441 requires Baghdad to declare all its weapons of mass destruction programs and missiles to deliver them by December 8th. The United States believes Iraq has been illegally rearming for several years. Inspectors exited Iraq in December 1998 and have been unable to verify whether Iraq has such a program. In an exclusive interview with Peace Watch, Iraqi Ambassador to the UN Al Duri says Iraq has been saying all along that the inspectors are welcome in Baghdad. We asked the ambassador to comment on what seems to be a revision of the facts around the exit of the first team of UNSCOM inspectors.
Many have said, and there seems to be a bit of confusion as to whether or not the inspectors left on their own in 1998 or whether they were kicked out of the country by Iraq, or exactly what happened.
No, absolutely not. This is really another story. Those inspectors at that time, led by Mr. Butler, have received order from Mr. Butler, and I think, and I also, the Security Council members here know very well, the United Nations know very well, that Mr. Butler received instruction from United States, from the administration of United States, to pull back all those people to go to Jordan. So they have had the possibility to attack Iraq at that time, and that it was the case. They launched us about with more than 430 long-range missile and destroyed the majority of our factories and our sites. So this is what the case, and this is very well known. Iraq never asked the inspectors to go out of Iraq. And this is very well known in the United Nations, but unfortunately it is unknown by the American media or American public.
Mm. Mr. Ambassador, Iraq accepted this resolution.
Yes.
Over and above the rejections, oppositions of the Iraqi parliament.
Yes, right.
How do you explain this discrepancy?
You know, the suffering of Iraqi people during these long years, and also the nature of resolution decided by the Security Council, really made the public opinion not in favor of that resolution. This resolution is full of mines, and we know that it will be full of surprises. And that resolution might be used by United States and Britain to create a problem, to let the mandate of those inspectors falling. So really, our National Assembly knows only one thing, that we want to get rid from the sanctions. But with that resolution, it is not possible. So this is what was the discussion, the nature of discussion within the National Assembly. But, you know, the decision is up to the to our higher authority, that means the Council of the Revolution of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
This council, at the head, our president, know very well that United States prepare a war against Iraq. So I don't think that we have any other choice than to have this path, that means peace, because war, we don't want war, and war means destructions, killing, mm-hmm. and the devastating of our country. So this is the real reason who push our commandment, our government, not to follow the National Assembly, because the National Assembly, they don't know exactly what is going on, what are the kind of preparation by American and the Britain in the area to attack Iraq.
So we
have choose the path of peace, as I said in my initial declaration in the United Nations.
Mm. Well, now, when you speak of the fact that the resolution is full of mines,
yes.
The resolution gives 30 days for a complete itemized list of everything not related to weapons productions.
Yeah.
That sounds like it could be one of those mines that you speak of.
Absolutely. They qualified it here in the United Nations as the first trigger. That's mean the first might be used as a trigger. So if Iraq failed to do that, that means the United States would attack Iraq.
So how, you know, some say Iraq has no possibility of compliance in that time frame. How do you intend to address that?
Yeah, we will present whatever we have. We will present whatever we have to the Security Council. You know, this is not a new one. We did present several declarations right now from the beginning till 98. And now we will repeat ourselves. And if there is something happened between 98 till now, that might be added to the other declaration. So we will present our declaration to the Security Council. This is one of the main discussion here with the member of Security Council, permanent or non-permanent. So we will present them. That means we will tell them what we have.
So are you saying,
if this would not satisfy the Security Council, I think it will be the duty of inspectors to go there. If American or Britain, if the Americans or the Britain, American administration or the Britain will tell them, will tell the inspectors where these sites, which might be a site of mass destruction weapons. So they might go there and they will discover it, and that means Iraq is lying.
Mm.
That might constitute a material breach. And it's up to the Security Council to decide whatever it wants to decide. But we are sure, we have the insurance, me, myself, I have the insurance from my government, to tell the public opinion that they will discover nothing, because there is nothing relating to mass destruction weapons.
Mr. Ambassador, are you saying that basically Iraq is going to resubmit the same declarations that it submitted to the inspections team up until 1998?
Well, if there is something new, I mean in the civilian sectors, for example, and this is might be benefit for useful for inspectors, and within the mandate given by the Security Council resolution, certainly we will give that to them for appreciation. This is if you have nothing in your pocket, you can give nothing from your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
So it is up to you, and the Americans said, the CIA and the M16 in Britain, they are always saying they know that Iraq have mass destruction weapons. So they have to go there and to tell the world, in the entire world, that there is, here we found these mass destruction weapons. And I think at that time, Iraq would bear the responsibility of not having tell the truth to the Security Council inspectors. Mm-hmm. This is the only way But anyway, Iraq certainly would present a report which might be benefit for useful for inspectors and for ANMAVOC and IAEA.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Ambassador, during the deliberations at the UN, the Arab states urged Iraqi President Saddam Hussein to accept the resolution and suggested that Arab experts be on the inspection teams. Have the teams actually been formed, and are there any Arab experts on them?
Well, I think this is not a real issue, really. You know, those inspectors nominated by Mr. Blix under some criteria used to choose those people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that Arabs did present their candidature to Mr. Blix. I think we have only one Arab within those 200 ones. But Iraq and its letter didn't ask that because we did accept those inspectors to be back, whatever their nationality, without taking care really about their nationalities.
Mm-hmm.
So this is not a very important issue for us. We wanted that those inspectors working in a good faith, in a neutral way, as international civil servant with integrity. And, you know, we have a very bad experience with the ANSCOM team,
mm-hmm.
Because it was discovered that, very well known now, even by Scott Rater, told the international public opinion, and he told everybody through the media, through television, that there were spies there. American one, British. This became a very well known issue by the United Nations. Mr. Blix assured us and Al Baraji, he assured us that would not be the case right now. We will behave as a civil servant without belonging to any other state, and we will work as a technician, not as spies, not as a politician, within these inspectors' teams.
So there are 200 or so inspectors that are going to be on the team. How many sites are they entitled or authorized to inspect?
We will give them the entire Iraq without restriction at all.
The palaces?
Absolutely. Unfettered inspection. Unfettered access. Wherever they want to go, they can go. So we would not give any kind of pretext of justification to those who want to wage war against Iraq. And I think this is what they did ask for several years right now. Now we give them this possibility. They have to come and to go to presidential sites as they did before, private houses, as they did before, schools, as they did before, laboratories, private laboratories, as they did before. So they have been everywhere in Iraq, and now we would like to give them the same possibility, so there is no any justification or pretext to be given to America to attack Iraq.
They can this time establish what's going to be known as exclusion zones from which Iraqis cannot leave or enter. What kind of impact do you think that's going to have on the Iraqi?
Well, I think this is. I think there is a propaganda significance for that. You know, ANSCOM did that all the time.
Mm.
This is not the first time, and we don't know why they want to put this, because it was happened before, and they sat around the area, and they didn't permit anybody to go or to enter or to move within the area. And they inspected the area.
So it's nothing new.
Do you know something that very rare people know it? That inspectors, that Iraq itself indicate to inspectors where these, especially mass destruction weapons, chemical destruction were. So the inspectors didn't discover anything in Iraq. Iraq itself wanted to really to get rid from these weapons, and he told those inspectors where these weapons stockpiles. So now we know exactly that we have nothing to hide.
Mm. Well, now, what about if you say that the exclusion zones were in effect all along, what about the fact that now the inspectors can take Iraqi officials and their families out of the country? Is that a practice that they had been doing all along as
well? No, this never was the curse. And I think we have the insurance from Blex and others that they would like to interview Iraqi people in Iraq because there would no need, and they cannot oblige any person to go outside with its family. You know, what does that mean with all the political ramification on that issue? And this is against human rights, is against everything, and against the... I mean, it's not acceptable by anybody, even by Security Council members.
Iraqi Ambassador to the UN Al Duran in an exclusive interview with Peace Watch. We'll have part two of that interview next week. That segment was produced by Reem Kathuda of Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington.
If I could sing a song for every bomb that flies, I'd sing each and all the days. If there were to be a verse for every dying child's cries, for every helpless father's gaze. If I could write a love letter for each corpse as it's carried, I'd never still my pen. If I had to stop a moment for each one as it's buried, I'd never move again. But the stocks are going up. Somewhere in America. But I'll sing a song for Basra. Could shed a tear for every home.
David Rovick's song for Basra. Recently, we spoke with Ramzi Kiesa, a member of the Iraq Peace Team from Voices in the Wilderness, a Chicago-based humanitarian organization on the ground in Baghdad. He spoke with us about the popular American impression that the war would be welcomed by the Iraqi people. Now, you're there as a member of Voices in the Wilderness, a campaign to end the economic sanctions against the people of Iraq. So you have obviously been exposed to the devastation that these sanctions that have been imposed by the U.S. against Iraq and the people of Iraq for some time now. You're familiar with the impact that it's having. Yet at the same time, President Bush and those who would like to go to war with Iraq say that they're doing that in the best interest of the Iraqi people because he has used chemical weapons against his own people and that they want to prevent him from doing that in the future. How do you rationalize those two vastly different perspectives?
You know, I find it absolutely appalling that anybody could possibly make the argument that they are going to begin a war in this country in the best interest of its people. I mean, it reminds me of the statement of that lieutenant in Vietnam who said, we have to destroy the village in order to save it. You do not save lives by taking them. You do not help people by destroying the infrastructure that they depend on. Their water treatment, their electricity, the sanitation facilities, the roads, transportation in a country. If there is a bombing campaign in this country, then for sure, thousands of innocent people will die as collateral damage. There is no such thing as collateral damage. If during that bombing campaign, the United States targets the civilian infrastructure of this country, as we did in 1991, then for certain there will be tens of thousands of deaths as a result of the epidemics that will start because there is not access to clean and safe drinking water. Once the United States does overthrow the government here, the army should collapse along religious and ethnic lines. Then the resulting civil war could make Lebanon or Bosnia or Northern Ireland look like a schoolyard brawl. We could be looking at hundreds of thousands of deaths if there is a civil war here. And none of those things are in the interest of the Iraqi people. When I talk to people on the street here, nobody wants to see a war. Nobody wants to see an American invasion. There is nobody in this country who is convinced that a war or an invasion would help them or would be in their interest.
Well, you say now, regardless of what people may feel about their government, what do people feel about the government? How do you assess it, and what do the people of Iraq feel about it?
Most Americans can guess how the majority of Iraqis feel. I think, though, that if there is a war, the vast majority of people are going to do their best to hide. They are not going to be coming out in the streets cheering the Americans on. Think of it in my head as maybe 15 or 20% of the country that would support the government here, and another 15 or 20% that might very well support the Americans, but that the vast majority of people here will do everything they can to get out of the way and not get shot and not get bombed and not get hurt.
Okay. Any final thoughts on your part, Ramsey?
Yeah, you know, Americans really have to come to grips with the reality that their security cannot be dependent on the insecurity of other people around the world. We cannot protect Americans by making other people unsafe. 3,000 Americans were killed a year ago on September 11th, and that was an absolute atrocity. But hundreds of thousands of people in this country have died as a result of the destruction of the civilian infrastructure here in 1991 and the sanctions that have blockaded its repair. And those people are just as real as the Americans who died on September 11th. Their family's grief is just as strong. Their anger is just as righteous. And until we begin to see that all of us in this world are together, are in this together, and that our security depends on everybody else's security, then I think we're all going to be in for a lot of pain. If we leave this up to the governments, I think we're all going to be in for a lot of pain. As human beings, I think we need to reach out and begin making human connections with people around the world, with people here in Iraq, with people in Afghanistan, in Palestine, in Chechnya, in Kashmir, in all the conflict zones of the world, and begin to build long-lasting relationships based on our own mutual security and not on the insecurity of those who we believe we oppose.
Ramsey, what is your role there in Voices in the Wilderness?
We're beginning a project called the Iraq Peace Team, where we hope to bring over at least dozens and possibly hundreds of internationals to live here in Iraq before, during, and after any future U.S. attack. And we will be here to do humanitarian work and help people here in this country. And we will be here to provide an independent source of reporting to people in the United States about what is going on in this country. I think we saw 12 years ago during the first Gulf War, you know, pretty lights over the skies of Baghdad, and we were told that this was a war. But war is not a video game. And when the bombs start falling here, people will start dying. And our group is going to be here to make sure that Americans can't forget that.
Ramsey Kaise is a member of Voices in the Wilderness, dedicated to ending economic sanctions against Iraq. Today, Black Voices for Peace and Black Voices for Peace People Action Network picketed in front of the headquarters of the Washington Post newspaper to launch the Fairness in Media campaign. Damu Smith, founder and chairperson of Black Voices for Peace, says our aim is to press for fairness, balance, and accuracy in reporting by major media and other news outlets. After the October 26th national anti-war rally attended by more than 150,000, the Post ran the story in the Metro section. According to Smith, there's been a deliberate decision not to cover anti-war activities by blacks and other people of color.
Fair reporting equals justice. Fair reporting equals justice. Fair reporting equals justice.
We want to make the corporate mainstream media accountable to the consumers that they serve. And we're going to do that by not just protesting out front of a corporate headquarters, but we're going to have a letter writing and email campaign to the editors, owners, and other important officials at the newspapers and television stations and radio stations, both in D.C. and around the country. The second thing we're going to do is to support black media and independent progressive media who have been doing everything they can to report accurately on the anti-war activities and the role and involvement of black people in those efforts. And so in Washington, D.C., for example, newspapers like the Washington Informer, the Washington Afro-American, the War Report, Indy Media, Pacifica, WPFW, all of those newspapers and other media organs who have been supportive, like WOL, and we want them supported. So we're not just here to protest the corporate media, but we're here to help ensure that independent, progressive, and black media, who have been doing everything possible to accurately and fairly and in a balanced way report on the anti-war activities and to report on the role of black activists and other people of color in that effort, we want to make sure that they get supported as well, whether it's through purchasing ads in those newspapers, whether it's through asking people to purchase those newspapers and to listen to those radio programs and TV programs. That is what we plan to do. The other part of this is that the Washington Post is where we are launching our campaign today. The Washington Post has been very unfair and very unbalanced, just like the rest of the media, in terms of how they have reported on the anti-war movement. Indeed, they did report on the 100,000-plus protests that took place on October 26 here in Washington against the war, but they relegated that story to the Metro section, which was an inappropriate placement of that story. And in addition, they put a small photo below the fold on the front page in the A section. That should have been an A section story on the front page, preferably above the fold, but anywhere on the front page with a lengthy article would have been great. The second problem with the Post is that they have refused to be consistent about reporting on the involvement of Black Voices for Peace and other black activists in the anti-war movement. For example, on September 9th, they did not send a reporter to our event at Howard University, which was a national event that had people like the distinguished Professor Ronald Walters, Barbara Reynolds, who used to be an op-ed writer for the USA Today, and Dr. Julianne Malveaux, who appears on CNN and other news outlets from time to time. There were several of us there. They didn't come. They did not report accurately on our protest that we staged this past summer at the Israeli embassy. They did not report that Black Voices for Peace sponsored that protest. They didn't interview any of us. And when they reported it in the Metro section, they reported it as a mostly air protest, which was false. More than one-third of the protesters there were African-American and black. A third of them were white, and a third of them were Arab and Jewish. The other thing that the Post did not do is earlier this year in January, when we had nearly 1,000 people at our national Martin Luther King Forum on Peace with Justice, they did not report that event. Instead, they did report on the activities of white peace organizations, things that they staged that same weekend. But they did not report on nearly 1,000 people from around the country in the Washington metropolitan area coming to attend that event. So the Post has been a player in the unbalanced, unfair, inaccurate reporting that the corporate media has been conducting in regards to the anti-war movement and black and other people of color involvement in it.
Free press will set you free! A free press will set you free! A free press will set you free!
Damu Smith, founder of Black Voices for Peace from downtown Washington in front of the Washington Post. That piece produced by Peace Watch intern Marcus Tyler Brown and editor Lona Elias. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. When we come back, former UN Weapons Inspector Scott Ritter and more.